Okay, we're talking about spectroscopy, which is fundamentally a physical subject. So today it's more physics than we would usually do. I mean, it's possible to do spectroscopy just by memorizing tables of numbers of where peaks come, but I don't find that very satisfying, and I don't think you should either. I think it's better to understand why things work the way they do. And there's some really neat phenomena involved in these techniques of infrared and NMR and trying to understand them. Last time we started looking at coupled oscillators, this toy we have here, in order to illustrate several important concepts. One is how complex the vibration of atoms and molecules is. Another is how you can try to understand it in terms of what are called normal modes. That doesn't mean they're usual, it's just a name that's used to describe them. And then the concept of a phase of mixing, that's just like orbitals, you can add them or subtract them and use different amounts of them, and we'll be talking about that. The possibility that things might not be as complex as we would worry about, or as physical chemists would warn the organic chemists when they wanted to use IR to identify molecules. Okay, so we looked last time at this set of two oscillators and saw that in a simple case, you can stretch one and let it vibrate, and like that. And it vibrates at a certain frequency, and the square of that frequency is how stiff the spring is. So the stiffer the spring, the faster it'll oscillate, and it's inverse in the mass. Or, as we talked about last time, in more complicated cases, you might use the reduced mass, but essentially it's the mass of the particle that's doing most of the oscillation. Okay, now, if you have a coupling mechanism, so one knows what the other is doing, for example, by pulling this weak spring up here. And then if you hold one, the thing will oscillate a little faster, essentially because it has a stronger spring, because now it's stretching the second string as well as the first one. Okay, so that's what happens when you have a frozen partner. Just stretch one, let it oscillate, hold the other in place, and essentially you have a stronger spring. It's the original force constant plus that weak spring that gives the frequency. Okay, that's simple enough. And now, what's more interesting is when they're both moving at the same time. Now, one way they might move at the same time is in phase, like this, right? And obviously that's going to be simple because really the spring in the middle isn't doing anything. It's just moving back and forth, and we don't pretend it has any mass or anything. So it's just as if the springs were oscillating independently. If you wanted to treat them together, you could say that there's twice the force constant involved in the, because you're bending two springs, but there's also twice the mass moving. So you get the same quotient F over M in the same frequency as you had before. That all simple. Okay. Now, more interestingly, is if we do out-of-phase vibration, where they move in opposite directions, because now, obviously, we are stretching the central spring. So we could just put a dot in the middle of that central spring to show that that's not moving. So we're moving that central spring, essentially. It's twice as hard to stretch it, because two of them are stretching it, so you stretch it twice as much, or if you hold the center fixed, you're stretching half the spring the same distance you were stretching the whole spring before, so it resists you more. Okay, so that will vibrate like this. And now, and we can do it here to show you for real, like that. And now that has a higher frequency, because now we have the force constant is F plus 2S, right, over 2M, right? Or F plus 2S over M. So it's now a higher frequency when we've got it like that. Okay, so we understand in and out of phase coupling. And we can see that we've actually encountered this before. Because if we have the two isolated things that have a certain energy, a certain frequency, right? and we let them interact with one another, they can interact as a sum or a difference, right? Just like orbitals, there can be an in phase and an out of phase, a bonding and an anti-bonding. And the in phase is lower in energy, lower in frequency, and the out of phase is higher in frequency compared to what? Compared to the one that was frozen, not compared to the independent one, right? Because we have to take into account that central spring. So when they're coupled, we have these in phase and out of phase. Now in these are different frequencies, the in phase and the out of phase. But in either of those normal modes, those things are called normal modes, the two atoms are moving at exactly the same frequency. Right? They're staying exactly in phase with one another here, and they're staying exactly in phase with one another there. Okay? So that's what defines a normal mode, is a complicated way of all the atoms moving here too, but there could be 38 or 186, right? But all of them are moving at the same frequency in a normal mode, so the pattern repeats every cycle. Right? Now, it doesn't always work that way. Because, so that's what it says here, in such normal modes, all atoms have the same frequency. But different frequencies, obviously, for certain normal modes. And now notice, actually I didn't want that to be here, that is a mistake. So here's the out-of-plane, out-of-phase motion, and here's the in-phase motion. Okay. Now, suppose I did them both at the same time. Both the out of phase and the in phase happening at the same time. Right? So this is the in phase, and this is the out of phase. Okay? Suppose I add those two together, in phase and out of phase. What happens to this one if I add them together? Here's in phase, here's out of phase. How about this one? It doesn't move, right? Because it moves to your left in the in phase, to your right in the out of phase. Add the two together, it's not moving, right? How about this one? It moves twice as far, right? So this one, where this one is not moved, and this one is moved, right, is actually a sum of two normal modes. And if I let that go, they don't stay in phase with one another. Right? That's that weird one which bounces back and forth. Right? So the atoms are not moving at the same frequency in this. Everybody with me? Okay, but it's a combination of two normal modes. Now let's look at it here. Okay, there's the out of phase plus in phase. Right? So we move the one on the right and not the one on the left. And if I superimpose the two normal modes of different frequency, the vibration switches between the oscillators as the two modes beat in and out of phase. Now here's where I wanted to show that vase that was not supposed to be on the previous slide. I'll take it out. Okay, so suppose I take the high frequency mode, that's the out of phase, and the low frequency mode, the in phase, different frequencies, and I let them mix. What will happen? We'll get two combinations, one which is mostly one of those and close to it in energy, the other is mostly the other one and a little bit higher. So it's exactly like what happens in orbitals, and for the same mathematical reason. Let's look at these two. Okay, there's the normal mode, which is in phase. Notice it's mostly the vibration of the heavy one, the slow vibration, the low energy vibration. It's mostly that, but there's a little bit of vibration of the one on the right. Now I won't be able to get it exactly right, but if I move this one just a little bit and this one a lot, that's close to that normal mode. I didn't get it quite. They're not quite in keeping in phase. But if I did just the right amount, so the sum of this and this was just the right mixture, then they'd move in phase with one another. And I'm close, but not exact, okay? So most of the devotion in that one is of the heavy one. Okay? Actually, I've got it backwards from the way it is on the screen. Well, okay, all I have to do is do it this way. Oh, no, wait a second. I haven't got it right. Because I want it to be two different oscillators, right? This one is high frequency, and this one is low frequency, right? Now, if I go like this, then lots of that and a little bit of that, it didn't do right. I did too much of this one. Sorry that this is hard to do. And it's still beating. But I assure you that if I could do it just right, they would move exactly in phase with one another, but one much more than the other one. So that would be one normal mode of the thing where the two frequencies are not the same to start with. There's a low and a high. So energy mismatch. Okay? Or if I looked at what would the high energy one look like, the OOP, as I called it there, what would it look like on this? What would be moving, mostly? I've been talking too fast. Right? So one of them is mostly this, and a little bit of this, in phase. The other one would be mostly this, and a little bit of this, out of phase. And I didn't do it right. But I did it right on the slide. Okay. So the other one, the out of phase, is mostly on the left and a little bit on the right. Mostly the high frequency one on the left and just a little bit of the other one. Right? So the point of this is that if the coupling isn't too strong and the frequencies are mismatched, right? Sufficiently mismatched, then they behave more or less independently of one another. They don't mix very much. Right? So the physical chemist told the organic chemist, don't try this IR stuff, because all these springs that hold the atoms together, bending and stretching and so on, will make it so complicated that you'll never be able to understand anything, because everything's moving all at once. But in fact, if there's something that isn't too strongly coupled to other things, and is rather different in frequency from the other things, this being slow and this being fast, right? Then it will pretty much stand alone. There will be normal modes that are pretty much just a local node mode of one thing. And we've seen that exactly in orbitals too. If you have an orbital whose energy is very different from anything else, energy mismatched, and not too much overlap, then it behaves like a lone pair or something like that. You can treat it as isolated. And the same thing is true of vibrations. Okay, so in a case like that, so that's what we're going to, those are ones we're going to be able to interpret, right, when they're local, not very complicated of everything moving at once. Okay, so there's a combination of out of phase and in phase. Okay. Now, a general molecule with n atoms has 3n independent geometric parameters, because every atom has x, y, z, and they can be anything. So there are lots and lots, 3n parameters. You could use Cartesian coordinates, x, y, z, or you could use internal molecular coordinates, the distance between atoms, the angles, the torsional angles. But however you slice it, there are going to be 3n of them. Okay? Now, three of those fix the center of mass of the molecule. So if you talk about things relative to the center of mass, you have 3n minus 3, right? And three more fix the orientation, rotation around the x, y, and z axes. So we can get rid of six of them if we're talking just about vibrations. So there'll be 3n minus 6 internal modes of vibration. They can be the normal modes. So there'll be 3n minus 6 normal modes. Remember, in each normal mode, all the atoms are moving in phase with one another at the same frequency. Right? So they can, if they generate a dipole in their moving, or change the dipole, right, that will interact with light. It can generate light. It can absorb light. Because electricity moving back and forth is what makes light. Okay? So there'll be potentially 3N-6 normal modes that can absorb infrared light. Okay? But not all of them will absorb infrared light. For example, consider H2 as it vibrates. Does that absorb light? Does that interact with light, H2, as it vibrates? Does it generate a dipole? Surely? No. No, it doesn't. It's completely symmetrical, right? So that wouldn't interact. H2 would not interact with IR, wouldn't absorb IR light. Okay? It's just, it's like in the atom. Remember when it breathed like this, mixing 1s and 2s? That didn't interact with light, nor does the stretching of H2. How about the stretching of Cl2? Is that going to interact with light? Max, what do you say? Pardon me? It's not. It's more electrons, but again, it's moving symmetrically. How about HCl, Max? That'll do it because H plus Cl minus is going to generate light or absorb light. Okay, so we got to look at the normal modes, see what they are, and whether they're going to interact with IR light. So that's going to, the strength of their interaction with IR light is how high a peak is going to be, how much light it's going to absorb. The stronger it makes an electric field change, the more it interacts with light, the more light it absorbs, right? And the horizontal axis in our spectrum is the frequency of that normal mode at which all the atoms are vibrating at the same rate. Okay, now 3N-6 mixed up normal modes sounds hopelessly complex, though it might be good for a fingerprint. It's very unlikely that two different things would have the same complicated combination of all these things. In fact, for practical molecules, it's impossible. All molecules have characteristic IR spectra, except for simple things like H2Cl2 that don't absorb. Okay, but mixing requires that you have frequency match, right? That the normal mode have the same frequency as the light, and that you have a coupling mechanism for interacting with the light. That's that change in the dipole moment that's going to control how high the peaks are. So if you have isolated vibrations and then you couple them, right? You're going to you have to have energy. It's like the case in orbitals that you have to have energy match and orbital and overlap. Here you need frequency match and a coupling mechanism, the overlap sort of between light and the molecule or the molecule's vibration. Okay, now let's look at a real molecule like butane. Okay, now there are 3 × 4 + 10, that's 4 carbon atoms, 10 hydrogen atoms. Am I right about 42 degrees? Was 14? No, I'm wrong. It's not. It's 3 × 4 + 10 atoms. That's what N is. I wrote this wrong. And there are 3 of those minus 6 normal modes. Lots. Okay? So I've got the degrees of freedom written wrong there. Okay, so you have minus 3 translations, minus 3 rotations. It's not 36. It's a lot more than 36. I'll correct this. Yeah?
Is a degree of freedom equal to a normal mode?
Yeah. A degree of freedom will be a normal. Well, degrees of freedom are those 3N. Degrees of freedom, but some of them correspond to translation, some of them correspond to rotation. That's 6 of those degrees of freedom. The ones that are left are vibrations. Okay, so that's why I subtracted the 3 and 3. Okay, so C4. Those 4 have 3 stretches. You can stretch each of 3 bonds. 2 bends. You can bend the first and second, or the second and third carbon-carbon bonds. And there's 1 torsion, twist, right, for the carbons. For the 10 CH bonds, there are 10 stretches and 20 bends or twists. So there are lots of these local vibrations. But the problem is they're going to couple together, right, as we showed here. So you're going to get complicated normal modes where, in general, all the atoms are moving. So let's look at that a little bit. So it's mixed according to frequency match and coupling into 36 normal modes, but it's going to be more than that because I calculated wrong. Yeah. Wait a second. Have I done wrong here? I was right. The three, of course, is the three is there explicitly. It was right. I was wrong. Sorry, I can't think on my feet. Is everybody with me now? Slide is right. Doesn't need to be corrected. There are 36 normal modes. Thanks, Shirley, for pointing that out. Okay. Okay. So here's C8. H18, the straight chain hydrocarbon, and here's its IR spectrum. Now there are lots and lots of peaks there. Some are very strong, some are very weak, some come in similar frequencies to others, some are far apart from others, right? Let's see if we can see what some of these normal modes are. What do you think is going to happen at real high frequency? Remember that from what we see here, There'll be things where high frequencies interact with high frequencies. There'll be things where low frequencies interact with low frequencies. But the high frequencies and the low frequencies won't interact much with one another because of the poor energy match, the poor frequency match. So what kind of vibrations are going to come at really high frequency? If we're going to start on the left of the plot here and look at these, there are a bunch of them here that are much higher frequency than anything else. Okay? What kind of local motions should happen at really high frequency?
The stretching of the stage bone.
Why?
Because of what we talked about yesterday and how mu is really close to 1.
So right. So for CH stretching, the frequency is going to be very high because H is so light, right? So these are going to be CH stretchings, right? And then the ones that involve carbon-carbon stretching are going to be at much lower frequency, and still lower frequency will be things that involve bending, which is easier to do, a weaker spring, than stretching a spring. Okay, so let's see what that looks like. Let's look up here at the top. There are going to be 72 normal modes for 26 atoms. Okay, but not all of them will be IR active. Some of them will have no net electrical change. Okay, so let's look at this peak right here, which is this. Watch the motion. What's happening? What's changing mostly? There are lots of atoms moving, but can you characterize the nature of the motion? What's most of the motion? It's CH stretching, right? Now, what direction is the dipole moment changing? Can you tell? Here, all the hydrogens are low compared to the carbons, down. Here, they're all high, or almost all. Do you see that? Here the H's are high and the carbons are low. Here the hydrogens are low and the carbons are high. Do you see that? Right, so if the carbons and the hydrogens have different charge, what direction is the charge moving? Up and down. Okay, so if we put an electric field on that way, it'll push the hydrogens up. Or down, up, down, up, down. Got the idea? So if you have light that's coming in where the electric vector is oscillated in this direction, at the correct frequency for when all these move according to their springs and their coupling, then this will interact and absorb that light. Okay, Brian?
Along with the bottom hydrogens on the leftmost carbon.
That's the normal modes have nothing to do with the light. The normal modes have to do with what the masses are and what the springs are, right? And it turns out that in this normal mode, that most of the hydrogens move up together or down together, but the ones on the end happen to move the opposite direction. That's established by the angles among the springs and everything, right? But net, most of the hydrogens are moving up together and down together, so the other two will just make it a little weaker. Okay, good. Thank you for asking that. Okay, so there we got that. So that's a CH stretching vibration. Right? It's a bunch of CH stretching vibrations coupled together. Now, let's look at this peak, or one of the peaks that's under there. Okay, now that's this motion. Now, tell me what's happening here. Locally, what's happening? CHs are stretching and shrinking, right? Which direction is the electric, the dipole moment changing as this happens? Matt? It's in and out of the board, right? The hydrogens are correlating. Here they're moving out of the board. Here they're moving into the board, right? So an electric field in that direction, changing with time, can force them back and forth and excite this mode to make it oscillate at a higher amplitude. Okay? Okay, so that's also a CH stretch and a different normal mode with a different higher, it turns out, frequency. Okay, now how about this one? What's happening here? Locally, it's CH stretches, right? How is the dipole moment changing as this happens? Hila? It's not. They cancel one another. So how about the interaction of this one with IR light? It won't, right? It'll be quiet as far as IR is concerned. It won't interact with IR light. So there isn't any peak for that particular normal mode. Okay? Everybody got me? So you won't see that one. It turns out there's another kind of spectroscopy called Raman spectroscopy, which works in a different way, which can show you interact with that vibration. Right? But that's not what we're talking about now. IR, that's called forbidden. It doesn't interact with light because it doesn't change the dipole moment. So this is a kind of breathing like the 1S to 2S. Right? No dipole change, no IR peak. Okay, and it turns out that half of the CH stretching combinations that you could have, there should be 10 of them, half of them are not active. So there are 5 peaks in that region that are different combinations of CH stretching that are active. Okay, now let's look at this peak. That's going to involve motion of heavier atoms. Okay, now here's the vibration that gives that peak. And actually I was wrong. It's not vibration of heavier atoms. It's vibration with weaker springs. What's happening? Is it stretching the CH bonds? What's it doing, Mike?
Bending.
It's bending. So remember, bending is a weaker spring than stretching. So this comes at lower frequency. Okay? So that's called a scissors mode for obvious reason. Right? We look at it. It's like scissors. Okay, and now this one here, and there'll be many combinations of scissor modes. Some are IR active and some are not IR active. Let's look at that peak there. It's this one. What's happening here? This mode has a cute name. What? It's the umbrella mode. See why it's the umbrella mode? And again, that's a bending of the CH bonds, HCH. But there's also a little bit of carbon stretching going on in that. Okay, and now that weak peak there is this one. And that's called a wag of the CH2 group. Right? And finally, this one here is this motion. And that's a rock. It's going like this. You could do an exercise class with these things. Okay? So there are all these different normal modes. Now, most of them, they interact with one another, and it's not so easy to understand. And mostly, you use these things for fingerprints, right? But let's look at cases where it's not fingerprints, but where you can actually identify functional groups. For that, of course, we need a functional group. So instead of octane, let's use octyne. We got a triple bond in there. And now you see that there are CH stretches, naturally, as you'd expect before. And they're the scissors and the wags and the bends and the rocks, because you have the same kind of CH2 groups. But you have something that's different, which is the triple bond in 4-octyne. But let's compare 4-octyne. And notice, incidentally, that peak is exactly the same. Do you remember what that is? What that peak is? And look, it's exactly the same if we take 1-octyne. That same peak is there, right in the same place. You remember what it was? That's the umbrella mode. Here it is. Here it is in one propyne. Okay. So that's that umbrella mode. So that really is the same in all of them. But if we have 1-octyne, it's a triple bond. We have a peak here at 3315, which isn't in either of the others. What's going to come at really, really high frequency in 1-octyne? What makes things high frequency? Eric? What makes high frequency? Strong bond. What else?
Good
energy match or something? No, that's not it. Because we're talking just about a single bond vibration now. We're not worried about mixing with other things. This one really stands apart, right? It's far from other things. What else makes things high in frequency besides a strong bond? Kevin? Low mass. So where in this molecule do you have low mass and an unusually strong bond? Don?
The H that's
right. The H that's on the end of 1-octyne. Right? Why is it a strong bond? And why does that make it strong? It's sp hybridized. Right? So it's an H that's stretching and vibrating, but it's a stronger spring. Right? So here's that one. And you see several carbons also move a little bit, but most of the motion is of the stretching the CH bond. Okay, so we know that one. Now, and we know the one here, that's the umbrella mode. How about this? At really low frequency, there's something in 1-octyne at really low frequency that isn't in any of the others. It's not in octane and it's not in 4-octyne. Here's what that one is. What is it? What do you think is happening mostly? Brian?
Is it carbon triple bond carbon bending?
Yeah, it's the carbon-carbon H bending. Right? So bending is unusually weak. Right? This bending. And it's the carbons involved too in the bending that helps make it weak. So that's this out of plane or an out of line bending of the H at the end. Notice the reason you want a hydrogen to be involved is so that the dipole will be changing. If it were three carbons involved in that, right? Then you wouldn't change the dipole nearly as much. So you wouldn't have a strong peak. This is a really strong peak. So you needed the hydrogen there to get it to be strong. And you don't have that in 4-octyne, where the triple bond is within the chain. Okay, so here's something funny. 2120, that's really a very different frequency from anything we've seen before. Any idea what that might be? It's not a CH stretching. Those come at still higher frequencies. Right? Yeah.
C triple bond.
C, triple bond C, a very strong bond, a strong spring, a stiff spring, right? But moving heavier atoms, right? So let's look and see if that's what it is. Yeah, you had it. Good. Now, so that's the stretching of the C-C triple bond. Why didn't we see that in 4-octyne? It had a C-C triple bond too. Eric? It's in the middle of the chain, so it's symmetrical. There won't be any change of the dipole when you stretch it when it's within the chain. It's when it's at the end and you have a hydrogen on one end that it'll be unsymmetrical and do that. Okay? So there's no handle for the light to get hold of the molecule and make it stretch that way in the 4-octyne. Okay, now, here's trans 4-octene. And notice we have a new peak here that's very different from anything in octane. See where it is? About 1,000 there, right? 967. Okay. Now, what's that due to? Well, here's cis-4-octene. It doesn't have that peak, but it has another one further down. And it has one further up, 1655. Now, what do you think 1655 might be? So it's a much higher frequency than most of these things we've been seeing involving heavy atoms. Brian, you got an idea? C double bond. It's not as high as the C triple bond C, but it's much higher than CC single bonds. Okay? So that's that CC stretching. Now notice that you wouldn't, the molecule is symmetric when you, it seems symmetric right to left when you do that. You wouldn't think that would change the dipole. It actually changes the dipole in this direction. Because when you stretch that bond, it changes the nature of the other two bonds and the electron distribution in the two single bonds. And that moves up and down. So it's a different polarization of light that interacts with this one. The dipole change, it's a weak one, because it's not a very strong peak, right? And it's up and down rather than right to left, in which for which thing it would be symmetrical, for which vibration it would be symmetrical. But of course, in trans 4-octene, the thing is completely symmetrical, and that those two would cancel, so you don't see it in 4-octene. Now, we also have this 710 down there, and that turns out, in my view, to be the most interesting one of all. Right? And you can compare it to this double bond that's tri-substituted, so it has just one H here. These have two H's, one here, or in the trans, or one here and one here, or one here and one here. But this one has just a single H, and it has a peak that's in the middle of those two at 828. And now you can see what's really interesting here. We start with these, the blue and the red molecule have two of these CHs. Two of them here. And they can couple with one another. So we have two peaks like the green one that can mix in phase or out of phase to go up and down in frequency. I mean, it's more common to look at the diagram like this. Okay, so you get a normal mode that's higher frequency and lower frequency than having just one CH. And now we're going to understand that here. So we're looking at the IR active out of plane bending, the bending the CH out of plane. Okay. Now, here's the motion in all the cases. See the H is moving up and down? So in the top, there's just one hydrogen moving up and down. But in the bottom, there are two hydrogens moving up and down on the central double bond. Everybody see that? Now notice that I say the IR active out of plane. Because when you have two H's, they can either go in phase or out of phase. Okay, just like here. The two normal modes, in phase and out of phase. Okay? And notice that to be IR active, the two hydrogen atoms have to be moving in the same direction, because if they moved in opposite directions, they would cancel. Right? But it's different here. So here they have to both move up. Here they have to both move up in order to be IR active. But notice what this does to the double bond. That one is at 828 wave numbers when you have just one of them. If you mix two, there's going to be an in-phase and an out-of-phase combination. One will be higher frequency, one will be lower frequency. But which one is IR active? Okay, it's the one where the hydrogens move in parallel. Now on the left, that motion of the two hydrogens up twists the double bond. Everybody see that? When the two hydrogens move up, it twists the double bond and partially breaks the double bond. Right? And that's hard to do. You don't want to break the double bond. So it's high frequency. It's a stiffer spring. But on when the two move up, it preserves the pi overlap. It doesn't twist the double bond. So that one, the one on the left is hard to do. The one on the right is easy to do. The one on the left is high frequency. The one on the right is low frequency. And what this means is that in IR spectra, you can tell the difference in a disubstituted double bond. You can tell whether it's cis or trans by whether you have the 967 or the 710. So IR allows you to distinguish cis from trans isomers of double bonds when you have two hydrogens there. So I think that's a really neat implication. But the real crown jewel of infrared spectroscopy is the carbonyl group. Right? So here's acetaldehyde, and you see you got this really, really strong peak. Why is it such a strong peak? Why does it interact so strongly with the light? The CO stretch. Because it has a really strong dipole, the CO. So as you stretch it, you change the dipole a lot. Okay, so it's very strong, and it also is an unusually high frequency compared to most atom stretching, because it's a double bond instead of a single bond. Okay, so it's an unusual position in the spectrum, and it's very strong in its interaction with light. Being an unusual position, an unusual frequency, means it doesn't interact much with its neighbors like this, a high frequency and low frequency. So it stands more or less alone. Okay? So that's strong in absorption and independent. Right? So you're going to be able to identify a carbonyl group in many different compounds. Right, because it's going to be independent of mostly of other things. Now it isn't. It is somewhat dependent on the environment, and that's good because you can distinguish one carbonyl group from another. For example, the ketone has a slightly lower frequency than an aldehyde does, so you can tell an aldehyde from a ketone. But more interesting than that is what happens if you have an amide. There's the amide. Now, it comes at much lower frequency, the amide, compared to the aldehyde and ketone. Why? Why is the vibration of this lower frequency? Anybody got an idea? Mike?
It's just resonance stabilization with the lone pair.
So there's resonance stabilization of the lone pair. And how does that affect this, the strength of the CO bond? It makes it weaker because those electrons go into the pi star orbital of CO. So it's a little bit weaker than most CO double bonds, right? And it comes at lower frequency. So that's great. And this, you know, I've told you this before, but IR shows that it's really true that that bond is weaker because it's partly a single bond. Okay. Now, how about if we had, so the CO is weakened by resonance. Now, how about if we had an oxygen in place of having a nitrogen down there? What's the effect of that going to be? Kevin, what do you say?
It'll be something similar.
Why? There's a lone pair on the oxygen, right? Will it be a stronger or a weaker effect than in the amide? Is the unshared pair here higher or lower than in the than on nitrogen? It's lower, bigger nuclear charge, so it shouldn't mix as much. So you shouldn't get as big an effect here as you do there. So guess for me. I want to set you up. So if a ketone is here and an amide is here, where do you think the oxygen is going to come? Someplace in here, because it'll have resonance, but not as much. Okay? 1746. It's the wrong direction. So we're going to have to check again. In fact, let's look at what happens if we have chloride there. So you would have told me the same thing, except that these unshared pairs are really low, so it probably wouldn't go down at all, or very little. In fact, it's the highest of all, 1806. So what's this telling us about the bond? When we have oxygen or chlorine there, the bond is getting stronger instead of weaker, the CO double bond. Okay. What makes it get stronger? Yeah. You're close. Look at this. You have unshared pairs on the oxygen. On that oxygen, sigma, not pi, sigma unshared pairs. Can you see a LUMO that those might mix with? So there's a p orbital that's like this, that has an unshared pair of orbitals, an unshared pair of electrons. Where's an orbital low LUMO that it can mix with? Sigma star, right? And if you do that, you get this resonance structure, mixing the unshared pair on oxygen with sigma star of carbon chlorine or sigma star of CO, right? So it in fact makes it a partial triple bond. So it overcomes whatever was happening in the pi system with a little bit of unshared pair making this like a single bond. This is much more important. So it's more like a triple bond than it is like a single bond. It shifts it the other way, makes it unusually strong. So that C double bond O is strengthened by resonance. And now we have a really neat case. So we're going to use a vinyl group. Methyl vinyl ketone, and this CO is at 1720 here. Okay? Now, what would you have expected for this case? We have pi star here, or pardon me, we have pi electrons here that could mix with pi star. What would that do? Strengthen or weaken the bond? It would weaken the bond, the same as in the amide. Okay? But that's not what happens. This strong peak in the spectrum, the 1720, is at higher frequency than the ketone, not lower. And you don't have this really low sigma star here that could do this trick. Something else must be happening. And what's happening is coupling of the C double bond O and C double bond C, because they have similar frequencies, so they can interact with one another. Now let's look at that. So here's the vibration, stretching both of them out of phase. One stretches while the other shrinks. And most of the motion is of CO. Okay? But notice that that peak is doubled. There are two peaks there. Might it be that one of them is that mode and the other one is this one, which is mostly a motion of C double bond C and a little bit of the C double bond O? That is, could it be like this, that we have C double bond O and C double bond C, but they interact with one another and both are stretching or shrinking at the same time? So we would get 1720, a higher frequency, mostly the C double bond O, and a lower frequency, mostly C double bond C. Could that be it? The answer is no. It's actually 1618, which is the C double bond C. Right? Now, how do I know that? How do I know that it's the 1618 and not the other? And if the other one is 1618, why is that peak double? This is another application of IR that's really neat, which I'll go through quickly here on the next slide. Okay, so here's the spectrum of that same compound, methyl vinyl ketone, but taken in argon at 13 Kelvin, down near absolute zero. Right, and you see the peaks are shifted a little bit because it's in a different solvent and at a very different temperature. But you see that one that was like 16, 18, and this peak and this other one here. Now, watch what happens if I shine a laser on that. 2.5 hours of irradiation at 308 nanometers, and I'm recording not the new spectrum, but the difference between the new spectrum and the old spectrum to show what changed, right? And you see that there's some peaks that are positive, they got stronger, and some peaks that are negative, they got weaker. So what's happening is that 1696 is some different species, not the same molecule. It's something that's going away and giving rise to more of the stuff that's 1718 and 1623. That's how I knew which the other one was that went with the C double bond O, C double bond C, right in the previous slide, that those two went together. Now, here's the calculated positions for those two peaks, the C double bond O and the C double bond C, you know, that have come together and mixed. They're the calculated positions. So obviously that's the 1718 and 1623. What's the other one that's going away? It's that. There's the calculated spectrum for the other one, upside down. What is it? What's the new the compound that goes away and gives more of the one on top? It's the S cis and S trans isomers. So there are two isomers in there. That's why that peak was doubled. Okay, and that peak, the C double bond C here, is very weak for that S trans compound because the dipoles tend to cancel, so there's not much net dipole, whereas they reinforce in the top and you get extra strength in the CC. And so we have syn-periplanar and anti-periplanar isomers, and this peak you might still worry about. What's that? And the guys who wrote the paper think that is something entirely different. It's simultaneous excitation of two low-frequency peaks with the same quantum of light, so you get twice the frequency. So that's not something you need to know about. The point is, ignore that one. Okay? But this shows how you can use IR to follow a reaction to see things going away and coming in. Okay, that does it for today. Thanks.